The origins of the Canary Project go back to around 2005 when Ed and I both read a series of articles in the New Yorker magazine by Elizabeth Colbert, who's a science writer, prominent science writer.
2006,
thank you. And those articles were called The Climate of Man, I believe, and later became her book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe. She's an amazing writer. And they also, I think, really grabbed our attention because they were talking about the issue of climate change from like an experiential way. She was, as a journalist, visiting sites around the world where scientists were studying the current impacts of climate change, not thinking about it as a far-off, distant possibility. And she writes in this very chilling way. She's also funny, and the combination, like, I think really kind of gets under your skin. After reading these articles, we felt that we wanted to address the issue in some way. We felt a sense of urgency. And at the time, I had been through my MFA program. I was a couple of years out. I didn't have a big project I was working on. Ed at the time was a partner in a major white-collar private investigation firm. So he was organizing big cases and dealing with a lot of data and information. And we had also collaborated on art stuff since we've met in college. And so we decided to kind of do what Elizabeth Colbert was doing with her writing with photographs.
Happy New Year and welcome back to In the Weeds. I'm Nicole Asquith, your host. If I sound a little stuffy, it's because I'm still recovering from COVID. Turns out that even when you're vaccinated and boosted, COVID can pack quite a wallop. But I'm looking forward to getting back to our series on climate change. For our fifth episode in this series, I'm going to share with you a conversation I had with my friends, Susanna Saylor and Ed Morris. They both teach in the Film and Media Arts Department at Syracuse University. And as Susanna's already told you, they are the co-founders of the Canary Project. To talk to them, I drove up to their new home in Hudson, New York, where they've been working on their latest project called Toolshed.
You want something to eat? We have some snack cake.
A snack cake? What's snack cake?
It's just a fun two words that are fun to say together. It's rhubarb snack cake.
Like snack cakes it's like were coffee cake. Popular in the 70s, but they're making a comeback. Uh-huh. It's like a coffee cake, but it's not too sweet.
Yeah, I'll have a little snack
okay.
cake.
Yeah,
why not? For this episode, I was interested in how art can be a form of engagement with the climate crisis. Since Susanna and Ed have been working at this intersection of art and climate change for 15 years now, they're able to testify to how the culture around climate change has evolved and how their own work has responded to these changes. One little note before we get started, we'll be talking about images at various points in the conversation. And obviously, there's only so much that you can appreciate about an image by listening to a podcast. So I'm going to post pictures of some of the images that we're discussing on our website, in-the-weeds.net. So take a look as you listen, or you can always come back to the images later.
At the time, it's hard to remember now because actually I think the cultural field has changed quite a lot since we started. But in 2006, 2007, that's when we really started getting going. There was just a lot of skepticism and doubt still about the very existence of climate change. Politicians weren't able to say the word climate change, you know, in like a State of the Union address or something like that. And so it was really important to us to whatever we went to go photograph for there to be pretty sound scientific evidence that the things we were photographing were in fact attributable to climate change. So having those peer-reviewed articles and tying it to the IPCC reports was very important to our process.
Right. So, you know, we chose about 10 to 12 locations that we wanted to photograph, and they were specifically chosen to be places where the impacts were going to be felt by human beings. You know, we were specifically like, we're not going to places where there aren't humans, because we felt that there was already a lot of imagery of, you know, the polar bear stranded on the iceberg, and felt that we needed to have more of a sense of this as a human issue.
And yet there are no humans in the photographs.
Which we will talk about. The title of the project, the Canary Project, comes from the canary in a coal mine. And we thought of the images that we would be producing and the media that we'd be producing as warnings for the future. The project, you know, so eventually the Canary Project grew into more of a platform. We ended up working with a lot of different artists. And the Photographic Project got renamed A History of the Future.
Yeah, that's a very evocative title. So tell me about a couple of the places that you visited that really stand out in your memory and how that affected you.
You know, early on the project, partly because of our limited budgets, we did not go to the locations for very extended periods of time. And the first location that was a bit more kind of extended and in depth was photographing the impacts of melting glaciers in Peru. So the glaciers in the Andes are disappearing. It has an impact on the coast where most of the population lives and depends on runoff from those glaciers. So that was a very comprehensive shoot where, yes, we photographed the glacier, but also the infrastructure that brings water from the Andes down to the coast. We looked at farming on the coast. We looked at places in Lima. You know, the city is sort of expanding, but expanding without infrastructure. So the most vulnerable people on the edges of Lima don't have running water. They depend on water that comes in on trucks and has variable pricing depending on variability of, you know, water. So it was this very kind of comprehensive look at how that impact would affect different, both economic and human aspects of Peru.
I think about this question that you just asked about, like, locations that made an impact on us. It makes me think of kind of how our understanding of this issue has evolved. Mm-hmm. And just the very word understanding and the different shades of that, you know, the word understanding doesn't really capture degrees of depth. The whole project began with a form of understanding that was sufficient for us to be motivated to kind of go out and do this project. And we can directly attribute that to these articles by Betsy Colbert. But even so, while there was an emotional component to that understanding, it was more or less cognitive. I guess where it begins, like you say, oh, climate change, I have no reason to doubt this. I think it's probably happening. And then you go about your daily business. There is some other kind of understanding that can happen that can maybe spur you to take some kind of action or start evolving your work life around it, for example. But even after the Betsy Colbert articles, even after being motivated to start this project, the first location we went to, which was the Pasterze Glacier in Austria and looking at kind of melting glaciers there, I remember very distinctly standing in that landscape. And it's nothing that I can directly attribute, nothing I saw or heard that I can directly attribute this feeling to, but there was a sense of standing in this immense landscape, being very small in the landscape, and actually not seeing anything, paradoxically. Not seeing the glacier melt really fast or some kind of calving event happen where the ice falls off the mountain or something like that. But it was the quietness that was kind of eerie. And so it was some combination between being viscerally in this landscape that seems immortal or it's there from time immemorial, will be there for as long as we can imagine, and knowing. So it's the knowing that what's happening cognitively from the science and being in this place and the scale that really just sort of deepened the level of understanding. From that moment on, like our involvement with the Canary Project or the work that we do has been about deepening our own understanding and reflecting that deepening understanding to whoever sees the work.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an interesting sort of paradox there because as artists, not as scientists, although even as scientists, I imagine this is a bit of an issue, you're going to a landscape that you're not yet familiar with. So you know that it's being affected, but in a sense, the legibility of that must be difficult, right? It's not a landscape that you're familiar with. You don't know what it used to look like, although perhaps you were looking at pictures. And one of the problems with understanding climate change in general is the scale of it, right? And the fact that as human beings, there's a kind of limitation of what it means to understand.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it's interesting because I think that this position of not being able to fully read the land, of having the land have to unfold for you in real time, not rendering itself to your mental apparatus, it's kind of this calculable coherence of forces or kind of knowing exactly what you're dealing with. actually disorientation in a word actually helps deepen your understanding of it. I think that's a hard concept to get across somehow, is that disorientation is actually a very valuable tool for deepening understanding. And I think in some ways that's primarily what we intended to reflect through the pictures that we decided to actually, you know, produce. So, you know, the photographic process is you get hundreds of images and then you decide which ones you're actually going to make part of the project, and then you develop them and so on and exhibit them. I think we looked for those images that conveyed that disorientation, or where you didn't know how to locate yourself in the picture or in the environment, you know, as opposed to some other people's projects. You know, I think that's one of the things that was animating us in our editorial choices and motivated us to kind of, yeah, to make the project what it was.
Is that one of the reasons, oh, I'm sorry to interrupt, is that one of the reasons you chose not to include people in the pictures?
Precisely, yes, yeah, great follow-on question. Yeah, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, that was actually what I was going to bring up, was that, I mean, certainly we have images that have people in them, but they tend to close off the space for a viewer to have a sense of disorientation, because you very much focus your attention. I think as human beings, we identify a human being in the photograph and we are drawn to that, and the photograph like ends up being really all about that singular individual or small group of people.
And when you look at that person, when your attention is drawn to that person, there's all set of signifiers too that you then read into the picture that I think are distracting. If you have a person, you immediately start to make all these assumptions about the scene, and they also become very temporally specific. And it was crucial to the photographs that they be kind of agnostic or unlocatable in time.
Mm-hmm. That seems sort of contradictory to me, because aren't you trying to record a specific moment in time with respect to what's happening?
This is great. Yes and no. No. So the whole thing about the proposition of a photograph with respect to climate change is there's this extreme discrepancy between the photograph, which is the merest gossamer of time. It's an instant. It's a mere instant. And the scope of climate change, which is a geologic frame. You know, so in climate change, you're getting these human histories and geologic histories colliding. So how do you represent that? And I think the photograph is always going to be about the moment. You know, this was here then. But the topic is you know, obviously broader than that. So again, I think it's important to be disoriented with respect to time, not just place.
Maybe look at a picture. Do you have?
There's one right behind you.
There's one right behind me? Okay, all right.
We can look at any number.
No, that's okay.
I don't know if that's the best example, actually.
I'm going to have to move, but that's fine.
Yeah.
All right, tell me what I'm looking at.
So this is a photograph taken at a forest fire in eastern Oregon in 2008, the Umatilla fire. You know, at that time, actually, the fires were already increasing, but certainly not to the degree that it is, you know, this now. It's every summer, it's just kind of really out of control. So there's a number of pictures from this fire. Most of them are of trees burning. And then this one is kind of unusual from the others because it just shows the smoke in the sky, and it becomes, I think, more universal because it could be anywhere.
So, okay, I have a question for you about this.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful picture.
Yeah, and actually it's funny that the reason we're looking at it is because that yellow dot in the middle exactly matches that paint on the wall.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't paint that wall.
And that's the sun, right?
The sun.
So there's something, I mean, this is one of the other challenges, I think, for you guys, is that as artists, you're partly in the business of creating beautiful objects, right, or beautiful experiences, and yet, you know, this is a troubling
right.
Like the story behind what creates this is troubling. So do you think about that, the sort of tension between the beauty and the bigger story that is happening here?
Yeah, although, so beauty is a funny word because beauty is subjective, and I don't necessarily know that beauty per se is what we're looking for, but there is a kind of seduction that we're looking for in the images. That is, we want to draw one into the images. And, you know, there's a whole history of discourse around, well, is that ethical somehow to have the work be beautiful, as you say, or like aesthetic, and yet be about a troubling issue? Are you sort of somehow letting the viewer off the hook, or somehow making the issue of climate change into, you know, an object for commerce or an object of art or whatever? I don't really buy that. Yeah, I think every picture is a proposition, essentially, and you're asking the viewer to read it. And
you're also asking the viewer to feel it.
Right.
And that, I think this is the function that this kind of image, like it's large, it's 40 by 50 inches, that we want people to feel something when they see them. And so there's the scale, and there's also like a certain kind of seductiveness, as Ed said, to the image, so that somebody might be able to be drawn in.
Somebody is drawn in, right? Yeah. It's disorienting is one of the things that strikes me about it. You know, you're sort of instantly wondering where you are as a viewer.
Right. Like this
and,
movie, yeah.
And, you know, where you are in relationship to the earth. It sort of evokes the fire without giving you any kind of direct relationship with it, which I find interesting. All right. Do you have any landscape images we could look at?
Not like lying around. They're all like wrapped
up.
They're
all online.
Yeah, I mean, I would say all the images are landscape. That is, I would consider that a landscape too. Mm. It's a skyscape, but it's the same idea. But yeah, we can look at some other images here.
I'm just going to have a piece of that. What did you call it again?
Snackic.
I need to introduce that into my vocabulary.
I like those two words next to each other. Let's see here.
I definitely get what you're saying about people. You know, people are necessarily charismatic to people, right?
Right. And locate something very specifically in time, like by their dress or even the style of car. Mm-hmm. Like we don't even have, not only do we not have people, we usually don't have human artifacts. Or they're kept to a minimum, or they're kept kind of ambiguous.
Any particular image you want to talk about, Ed?
So these are the ones just that we're looking right now, the ones that are on the Sailor Morris site, right?
Yeah.
It's an interesting edit. We can talk about, we'd like to talk about this one.
Yeah. Okay, let me see.
That's one of our favorite images.
Tell me what we're looking at.
So this is Antarctica, and this is the Russian base, which is Bellinghausen. There's a church in the middle of the picture that they brought from Siberia in pieces and built there. And the red buildings or structures are where scientific research takes place. They chose a location in Antarctica with particularly bad weather, so it's kind of always stormy there. And this was photographed in those conditions. There was a lot of wind and snow, and it was gray. And
what kind of research are they doing there?
Well, a lot of scientists in Antarctica actually look at climate change, so that would be one of their areas for sure.
Yeah, so what I was going to say about this image, like many of the images that made the final cut of the project, contrary to what we expected, there's no visible impact of climate change in the picture. So we're just talking about this fire behind us, and that's a visible impact. I think when we first started, we thought, we're going to always be photographing impacts. We're going to show what global warming looks like. That was even a tag phrase early on in the project. But it became apparent that what we were trying to represent, if photography is representational, is not so much impacts per se, but this intimation of trauma or the potential for trauma in climate change. And this photograph here, there's something about the church in this desolate landscape. There's something about the relationship between kind of knowledge and belief in this photograph, because it's a science base, they're collecting data, but they felt compelled to put this kind of belief sanctuary in the middle of their science base. And, you know, we believe that climate change is as much or more about belief than it is about knowledge. And so this picture captures some of that, but it also captures kind of the human place in the landscape as well.
Can you expand on that? What you mean by climate change being about belief as well as knowledge?
This is kind of what I was talking about before, different forms of understanding. And I think that we know very well about climate change. We don't actually believe it. That is to say, even, you know, us, including us sitting here right now, I think there's a certain amount that we believe it, but that belief gets strengthened the more you interact with the topic or the more you know about it. And I think that's generally the gap between kind of knowledge and action, or actually addressing climate change, has to do with this discrepancy between belief and knowledge. And it's a funny thing to talk about, because you actually have to believe in the science, but it's not just the science. It's not just the science that you have to believe in. To understand what's at stake, you actually have to project yourself empathetically into the world. And that is kind of an active belief because it's a mental projection. Yeah, it's a mental projection.
Yeah, because we can wake up and look out and see that it's a beautiful day and you know, be happy that the sun is shining and it's not too hot and, you know, we'll just forget we're human. You know, we want to live our days and, you know, do the things we're going to do.
Well, it seems like a problem of scale in part. I mean, we don't exist in geologic time. We exist on a human scale, right? And so the fact that the two are kind of collapsing or colliding is, I agree with what you're saying. That is a big part of the problem. Aside from all the campaigns against the science of climate change, there's just the simple human problem of being able to fathom something on that scale.
Yeah, and hold that belief. Mm-hmm. And therefore act on it. And I think, you know, there's a quote by a French thinker, Di Sarto, belief is measured by strength of action. And I think, you know, we clearly, until recently, haven't been acting. I think there's been some real sea changes in the culture around climate change, understanding around climate change. In other words, the belief around climate change. I think it's becoming a lot more believable to a lot more people.
Mm-hmm. Well, more immediate, too, especially after, you know, what's happened this last summer. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for that. So we talked a little bit about the images. So one of the next decisions that you had to make is what are you going to do with these images? Where are you going to show them? How are you going to show them? So can you talk a little bit about that? I know you've exhibited them in galleries, but you also had campaigns to exhibit them in more public spaces.
Right. Yeah. So when we started the project, we were like very clear with ourselves and our advisory board that the images needed to not just exist in art spaces. And so we tried a lot of different things. They, for example, appeared on the sides of buses in Denver, a project that was sponsored by the Denver Contemporary Art Museum, along with very kind of dramatic text. They were designed by somebody who specializes in advertising. They had to be something that you could grasp and understand in the time that it takes for a bus to drive by. So a very different experience from standing in a gallery and having a contemplative experience. And we exhibited the photographs in that way as well. Also science museums, in which case the images are accompanied by a lot of information.
Yeah, I mean, it was this initial attempt to have the images do a lot of different kinds of work. And I think what we ended up finding out, though, was that the images themselves actually performed best in galleries because of the style of the image and the kind of things that we've been talking about in terms of what we're trying to convey. So that realization spurred us to start working more collaboratively or more like a collective or a platform, as Susanna said. So the images can't, for example, speak loudly or valorize collective action, then maybe we need to make posters. So we started a poster project, you know, or, you know, maybe the images can't make the impacts of flooding in New York City visceral to people or felt. So maybe we should work with this artist, Eve Mosier, to draw this chalk line around the coast of New York and of Brooklyn and Manhattan. So it's just, we started working in very heterogeneous ways because no project can convey everything. And that's, you know, one thing you start to realize, like, I think when we started the project, we had the sense, like, we'll show what global warming looks like and everyone will understand. And it's, you realize you cannot represent climate change fully. No one project can represent it fully. So you have to do all these partial things. And so it's kind of like a mosaic. And that really changed our approach starting in, what, 2008 or so?
Yeah, early on.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the posters a little bit. I was looking through the poster book and there were some really interesting ones. I think at the end of the day, the one that I like the most is the one with the scrambled words for
Scrummer,
the seasons. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I saw an image of that at a bus stop. Did you get any interesting feedback to what you did with that?
People really like that one. Yeah. And it's gone on to have a bit of a life, that particular poster. That poster was designed by a woman in France, Mathilde Fallot. And, you know, when we started the project, Green Patriot Posters, we started with friends, basically, designing posters or friends of friends. And we got some influential people to start designing posters, but ultimately opened up to anyone and advertised that. And that poster you're talking about was one of those submissions. And yeah, I think it's a really effective one for this disorientation we're talking about. That's all it does. That's the one proposition is like, it's going to scramble our sense of normal. That it's so readable with just four black words on a white canvas, that's great poster design.
You know? Mm-hmm. Makes you think.
Yes, simple, makes you think. yeah.
Another one that I liked was a little more sophisticated, at least in terms of legibility, is the one with the Washington Monument with...
You like that one? Yeah, that's interesting because there's a kind of playfulness to that one.
Yeah.
That's by John Santos.
Yep.
And he was one of the initial people we worked with in the Canary Project, actually. He was one of the first people to get us to think beyond the photography project, particularly because we had seen these designs that he did of the Epcot Center. So the Epcot Center being one representation of Buckminster Fuller's idea of kind of utopian design. It's a geodesic dome. And he showed this picture of the Epcot Center kind of combined with the Death Star. So, and broken, like Luke Skywalker hitting the bullseye moment of the Death Star. And there was something so fun, but also again, so legible about that image of this utopian vision that kind of become dystopian. And so he brought that same sensibility to the design with the Washington Monument in it. So there's all sorts of fun elements in that picture. I think there's flamingos in it.
Yeah.
And that's potentially, you know, you could read that in there. That's showing the southern climate moving north. But it's just like they're fun details. And then it's showing the symbol of America. I think there's windmills on it as well. Yeah. So it's like showing this kind of both a utopian future, but also there's these utopian elements in it. It's one of those images that requires careful looking to really get it. Yeah. But the Washington Monument there is like in your face. So it's you're impelled to do it. So even if you just read it on the level of here's the Washington Monument, that's America, here's a new vision of America involving renewable energy, that's one level to read it. And then there's deeper levels to read it too. So yeah, that's a cool poster. I'm glad you like that one. He's our good friend too.
Tell me about the chalk line project, because I'm not sure I read about that around New York City.
That project was initiated by Eve Mosher, who has a long career of working on climate change and art. It's a very performative project. It's kind of simple in its design. She set out to draw a chalk line along what at that time was the 100-year flood line.
Yeah, so yeah. It's basically 10 feet above sea level, which was in actuarial science, insurance science, the 100-year flood line.
Which is where, you know, just... It, for people who aren't familiar with that, it's where they would predict a big flood every 100 years. Like, so it's a very rare occurrence, right? And now we're seeing these floods happen more and more often. So she went out with one of these little machines that you use to draw chalk lines on playing fields. And it was something she'd push and it would put down this chalk line. And she covered 75 miles.
I can't remember the exact number.
Huge amount of it was, you know, the entire coastline of Brooklyn, Manhattan, etc. And it took months, you know, so she would set out, you know, a certain number of days each week that she was going to draw the line. And it brought her to all these neighborhoods that are impacted by flooding now. She had these information packets that she was handing out to people. She would stop and talk to people about what she was doing because they were like, what are you doing?
Right.
You know, what is this line?
And a great conversation started.
Yeah. So it really was also this sort of, you know, public dialogue, but, and a performance. So she needed certain kinds of help with a project that we were positioned to help her with, putting together a scientific advisory board, working on a documentary, helping her store her chalk in our studio space.
Documenting. Yeah, and both the Green Patriot posters and the High Water Line are good examples of projects where we kind of move to the background. We can become producers rather than artists and help facilitate these projects. And High Water Line, in particular, went on to have subsequent iterations in Miami and London that we didn't have anything to do with. We helped get it started, and once it got started, it has its own legs. It can get its own funding. We were really instrumental in setting some of the parameters for the project and helping it get noticed.
Well, it seems like you've been great community builders, and that is an instrumental part, I think, of any response to climate change nowadays. And so I'm curious about your experience of being community builders among artists in particular. Do you feel like there's something that characterizes artists' relationship to what's going on, or their social engagement with these issues?
It's a really interesting question, because when the Canary Project became this more of this sort of umbrella or platform for other artists to work within, we started getting feedback, because Ed and I have always had each other to bounce things off of, to talk, you know, about issues. We started hearing from other artists that that there was this sort of emotional weight around working on these issues that's really heavy for an individual, particularly if you're like out there witnessing these like really heavy things. And then not only that, but also it's very political. And at that time it was more political because people were denying. And so artists were concerned that they would be labeled political artists and somehow that would make them less like viable as artists. And so being able to work within this, you know, we never know exactly what to call it. I wouldn't say it's a collective, but calling it a platform, provided a sort of shelter for people. And, you know, it's interesting because we know of a few artists who in the last just couple years have decided to go back to school and are doing programs in divinity schools. And these are artists who have been working on climate change. They're friends of ours who work with Canary Project. And so, you know, if it was just one, I'd just be like, oh, interesting. But I actually know three artists. It's not like I think they're necessarily moving away from art, but they're also incorporating this kind of spiritual aspect through a master's degree in divinity.
I think we're going through another cultural shift at the moment, and we're reflecting that in our own work and what we're doing next, not to get ahead of your questions. but I think that drive to divinity school is part of that cultural shift, and it's part of recognizing this is happening, it's here, and like now how do we deal with it?
So it also makes me think about, we were talking about how as individuals we fail to understand in the kind of deeper sense. It makes me wonder if there are ways in which the only way of understanding is as a group. I don't know.
That's a really interesting question. I've never thought about it from that perspective. I mean, I certainly think that the only way for us to survive, and particularly survive in any kind of form of prosperity, is as a group. And one of the things we're very interested increasingly in is it's fostering collective sensibilities. Because there's no question that the kind of rampant individualism of our society and therefore the world is a big contributing factor to where we are now. Everyone's out for themselves, you know, and that kind of narrative of competitive self-interest is the dominating factor, not just in our species, but if it's somehow natural to the world, is, I think it's really time to upset that narrative, and it's not true. That's not the only narrative out there when you look at the biological world even. And you're seeing lots of these things occur. People discovering cooperation between trees or mycelial networks that share information and nutrients and so on. And it's just interesting that these narratives are becoming available just at the time that we need them.
Right. And, you know, this turn to a spiritual grounding, there's certainly models for collective belief systems that do look forward and consider future generations. For example, the seventh generation modality of governance that North American indigenous people live by, which means like you make your decisions based on how you imagine they will impact seven generations down the road. So, I mean, there's models for how to think collectively and behave collectively.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is just one example of why I think it's so important to reconsider indigenous thought and indigenous practices. In this non-romantic way, you know, I think there's a, when we talk about that way, the assumption is that you're speaking in some kind of, you know, new agey way, and it's not the case. And I think there's a lot to be said for ways of thinking about the world, ways of dealing with materials and resources that's pre-colonial, that's pre-extractive, and they're available. And I think a lot of Western thinkers are coming to the same place as indigenous thinkers have always been.
Mm-hmm.
And I think finding, and also just, you know, acknowledging that and not owning that as like the Western domain. I think those are very important parts of the cultural program of addressing climate and making a new future for ourselves.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, the seventh generation thing feels almost impossibly ambitious, you know, by the standards of our government.
And yet the Netherlands does it. You know, the Netherlands is an example of a Western, highly modern, whatever, government that always thinks on 1,000-year timelines.
Mm-hmm.
Because of their flooding
issues, they've had to do that. So, yeah.
Well, and when you talk about indigenous culture, I think that you find some of the similar strains in indigenous culture all over the world, you know, including in Europe. One of the things that's interested me is animism. There's a history of ideas of animism if you go back to pre-Roman times in Europe as well. So
completely. I just want to jump on that quickly though. Because I'm excited about that idea because it's funny to think of indigenous Europeans in a way. It doesn't make cognitive sense, but that there it exists. And I just read this novel, old novel called The Growth of the Soil by Knut Hamsun. I happened upon it. It was just one of those things where you pick a book off someone's bookshelf and you read it. But it was so appropriate. It follows these people settling the land in far out wilderness spaces in Norway. And there's a strong sense of animism and a strong connection to the land that comes through the characters in the book. And it's interesting to see that place in Europe as well as in other indigenous cultures.
Yeah, absolutely. We're finding that we have to go back to past ways of knowing. So given that you have so much experience now with different kinds of artistic engagement with climate change, how do you feel about art's ability to be a form of social action? When do you see it work? What are its limitations? How do you feel about it in general at this point?
That's another great question. I begin by saying my belief, but belief in the capacity of art to help with social change is not diminished, it's only strengthened since we've been doing this work. I think that it's just understanding how that happens and carrying with you a theory or a picture of change and understanding how cultural production contributes to that. I think where things get confusing or art seems under indictment is like it's very difficult to create a metrics or some kind of quantitative relationship between a given artwork and a particular change, you know, in the same way that you would have, say, with a nonprofit that's seeking to increase educational opportunities in an urban environment or something. Art, it works in combination with other things, and it plants seeds in people that you don't know how are going to germinate. And so I just have a faith that it does. I can't prove it, but I definitely believe it does, and it makes logical sense that it does, because the worldviews that we have, the ways that we think about acting in the world, they're not created spontaneously. They're coming from somewhere. And so any effort to change the cultural environment are going to have an impact on people, and I don't think that a single artwork does that as some silver bullet or something. I don't think that the work that we've done, you know, I couldn't say like, we did it. We helped change the cultural environment. But I have faith that it did in some small way. And, you know, climate change is one of the things like everyone's got to do to help out.
Everybody's got to do what they can.
Everyone's got to do what they can. This is what we do. This is what we do. And this is what we're doing. And I think it does have an impact. I can't measure it. And I think it kind of happens through concentric circles of influence, you know. And I can say that our lives were changed by a artwork, you might call it, a piece of writing, Elizabeth Colbert. It had a direct influence on our lives, and we've gone and made our work, and we've had some kind of influence on some people who've gone on to do whatever they're going to do, and that's how it works.
Thanks, Susanna.
Yeah, you know, I agree with that. I don't think it's very quantifiable, but the kind of, I think, dialogue and the kind of, like, room for making an emotional space for dealing with these issues is vitally important. I mean, getting back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, the artists who work within the Canary Project valuing this space where they could be together. You know, we hear from our students, because we also teach, that they feel overwhelmed by climate grief. And, you know, addressing those kinds of feelings, I think you need something like art, which is a space that allows for feelings, allows for an emotional response. And I don't think it's as fast and effective as direct activism, as that kind of work. And we really value that kind of activism. But it's another kind of work that it's slower.
Well, one of the things listening to you talk that occurs to me is that it opens a conversation about value, right? Science is about knowledge, but it's not really about what matters to us, what we value. And that seems like an important space. You've been talking about space a lot to address the emotional piece of it.
Yeah.
But tell me more about your students. I was going to ask about them. What's it like engaging with younger people on this topic?
Well, my students, I have a sense that they know well that they've inherited this kind of catastrophe. Like, it is part of their psyche, which I think for our generation, you know, it is not, I think, as ingrained as it is for them. You know, we might feel guilt, we might feel fear, but they, for them, I think there's, I get a sense of an inevitability. Like, this is, like, going to be a very big part of our lives.
The most serious among them are grappling with some forms of paralysis.
Yeah.
And being overwhelmed. And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, some art, I don't think necessarily all art, is useful in kind of addressing that grief. And we kind of say that I don't really think you can really understand climate change without having some capacity of understanding this grief. Like, you can't, you have to work through the grief, or you're not really in it, actually. You don't really understand it. But I don't think that necessarily has to be paralyzing. And how that commitment to acknowledging that grief, even speaking to that grief, how that can get translated into mental pathways, passive action that aren't paralyzing, that do feel like joyful or even effective. Maybe some other artwork addresses that, or maybe some other activism addresses that. But I think, you know, that's important. That's important work, and that's also cultural work.
Absolutely. I have to admit, talking about this stuff, I automatically go into my parent gear, and it's pretty heavy.
It is really heavy. We, while, you know, doing this work, became parents ourselves, and it definitely changed how I think about it and feel about it, because it's, it becomes real in a way that you just can't avoid.
It's quite a difficult legacy to be passing on to our children.
Yeah.
Yeah. So going back to your students, what do you feel that your role is? How do you help them?
That's a good question. One thing is not to hide from that grief. That's one thing. So just starting by acknowledging that. And so I've actually, unlike Suzanne, I've actually taught a class directly on the climate crisis, and it's a studio art class, so they have to read about the climate crisis and then make work about it. We co-taught a class like that early on in our career, but I just did it last year again, so it's a different atmosphere. So that felt like the challenge number one. And also to convey that grief to other people, we had a broad spectrum of people in that class, and there were different levels of understanding and sort of just not shying away from that. But then beyond that is kind of, yeah, what you do with that and how you look towards the future. So we don't know what's going to happen, actually. And I think that there's a sense to think about the future as given, but it's not a given. And so thinking about that, again, it's sort of paradoxical how kind of opening up a pathway to the future really involves a commitment to the present. I don't know if that makes sense. Donna Haraway has a phrase, you have to stay with the trouble. And I think that's really where it's at, is just looking at what's in front of you, looking at where your sense of empowerment can be. And it's often local. It's like what's around you, and just move forward with that.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Ed and Susanna. For images and links related to the episode, remember to go to our website, in-the-weeds.net. I recommend you check out their Toolshed site as well. I'll put a link to it in the show notes and on the website. Coming up, I'll be talking to Chris Schaberg about his meditations on the Anthropocene and air travel. Let's hope that things are a little less COVID-y by the next time I talk to you. In the meantime, take care.